Edgar Cayce, in 1940, I think it was, indicated near Bimini in the Caribbean, I think his words in that sleeping reading, as it was called, were Atlantis would rise again. I made one of my more definite statements the other night. I stated unequivocally that I believe that the builders of these monuments, such as the pyramid, once lived on Atlantis. And when it says Enoch was not, for God took him, Enoch walked and talked with God and was not, for God took him. Where? I mean, everybody assumes he was the first astronaut without a ship. The Bible doesn't say that. It just says he walked and talked with God and was not. That means he was there and then was not. For God took him. Now I have a question. Where did he and God take their walks and have their talks? You see, modern evangelists have so cheapened communication with God. Robin flies by and goes, chirp, chirp. And they say, God told me. I've listened to evangelists, you know, carry on a conversation as they repeat it and say, now God told me, thus and so, and I said, God, now, and God said. I've almost prayed that God would actually speak out like he did to Moses. They would become holy streakers. You've heard of molecular displacements? It cheapens the reality of God. Even holy Moses, the poor old guy on the other side of the rock that heard God talking to Moses, thought God was talking to him, ended up respecting that voice and being awestricken by it, even hearing it on the wrong side of the rock. Oh, I know what they mean. He walked with God means he was righteous living. That isn't what it says. He was all of that. I'm sure he was righteous. That isn't what it says. It doesn't say he walked righteously. It says he walked with God. Where? Either God came down and walked with him, which ought to have produced a few earthquakes, or Enoch walked with him. Now, it never says, really, that God left the Garden of Eden never to return to it. He kicked Adam and Eve out. And it was still very much there because he put cherubims with flaming swords guarding the entrance to make sure they didn't get in again. You know what side they guarded? North, south, east, or west? Which was it? Huh? You don't know? Does anybody know? What does the Bible say? East, right? Well, if the Garden of Eden was in China, right on the shores of the China Sea, the cherubims were guarding against swimmers. You had to go west to find it. You know, most people consider Garden of Eden an acre or two. Now, I believe the Garden of Eden was on Atlantis. And God retired those cherubims because the chances of anybody getting to the tree of life was removed. And I believe that when God decided to build the pyramid, you see, people think they know when the pyramid was built because there's a little inscription above the king's chamber that has the cartouche of Cheops or Khufu. It's a forgery. It's Colonel Vice's vice. We'll be teaching on that when I get back to the pyramid. There are no writings in the pyramid, no hieroglyphics, in the land permeated with heathen symbols and hieroglyphics. There ain't none in the pyramid. None in the descending passage. None in the ascending passage. None in the grand gallery. None in the queen's chamber. None in the king's chamber. There are no writings at all till you get above the king's chamber. Colonel Weiss spent a lot of money. It was a day when you justified your trips by coming up with spellbounding discoveries. And he associated himself with some crooks, a real crook. One of the crooks ended up owning one of the finest hotels near the pyramid. Boring in desperation to find something no one else had found. Because Herodotus had said it was built during Cheops' reign. What did he know about it? He starts boring above the king's chamber and discovers those additional chambers. Lo and behold, not in the first report of the discovery, lo and behold, writings are found therein. About that time, the first textbook on the hieroglyphics had come out, and it could be obtained in a library in Cairo. He made a mysterious trip with one of his crooked companions to Cairo. And the hieroglyphics fit the hieroglyphics that anyone could have gleaned from that book that he could have seen in Cairo. But before he leaves, a second book comes out that makes a critical correction between a symbol for the king and the symbol for Ra. And lo and behold, another hieroglyphic is found. Well, the problem is, when analyzed closely, the pyramid was built from the ground up. That seems logical. But his hieroglyphics have a name of a generation later in the lower one. Like, here's two passages in the pyramid. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
I'm tired of reviewing. I like to talk about something else for a change. Above the king's chambers, for example, they find these other chambers. Well, now, if you find a hieroglyphic for George Washington here, and for Columbus here, that would make sense, because Columbus most likely could have been living when this one was built. Then Washington came along later and added another layer. But if you find George Washington here and Columbus there, it's hard to believe that somebody who lived generations earlier would put his signature in the layer above the guy below who came later. It seems very unlikely that Columbus would have signed this one and Washington that one. Likewise, old Colonel Vice miscued. They made a quick correction with the next textbook, and it gave him away, as the forger corrected. The problem was, the earlier generation of kings was in the higher bunch of rocks. And interestingly enough, 4,000 years ago, whoever wrote those hieroglyphics knew prophetically which side of those chambers Davison would bore into. I mean, Vice, rather. Here's Colonel Vice having to discover something because the other things have been discovered. He's boring up and finding passages, chambers above the king's chamber. Anybody got a pyramid book? Run and get it for me, somebody. I wasn't going to talk about this tonight, but it's an introduction to what I'm going to do. I want some people maybe have no visual image at all of these passages. And there must be a picture in this little pyramid book. Yeah, here we go. Over here, Jerry. You see, this is the king's chamber. And right there's a chamber and a chamber and a chamber and a chamber. Colonel Vice, just like the Arab who first broke in and found the passageway, he bored through rocks and broke into these chambers. Now, 4,000 years ago, how did they know which of these four sides, plus a top and a bottom, that he would bore through? Because the fellow who wrote the hieroglyphics just happened to write them all, luckily, on the wall he didn't bore through. You want me to go by that slow? Isn't it a marvelous providential happening that those kings putting their cartouche in those little passages? I mean, if you want to put your cartouche, you can find a better place than that. I mean, these were real modest kings hiding it up there. But they were smart. Clairvoyant. They said, 4,000 years from now, Colonel Vice is going to blast one side of these things open. So we better make sure we put all the writing on the other side. Little detective work, and the scholars have bought it down through the centuries because two things coincided, and you'll always fight harder for something after you say it than if you hadn't said it. So Colonel Vice pulled the hoodwink of the century. He made his investors happy. He came home a hero. He discovered and confirmed that Herodotus was right. Cheops built it. And his crooked buddy got a hotel for keeping his mouth shut. And they put the writings in there as a forgery. Once that stupid idea that we are bound to the pyramid being built in Cheops' reign is abandoned, then it's catch-as-catch-can. You find other evidence now and other criteria. Now, I am totally convinced in my mind, like other things, you can't prove it. Historical certainty is a relative matter. By definition, you historians know that historic certainty is an abstract concept. You can have historic certainty when every logically available piece of evidence is in. Now, being an eyewitness is logically available, but experientially it isn't when the moment passes. So from that moment on, any historic event is relatively ascertained. That's why it takes faith in history to take your benchmarks and act on them. It takes faith in science to take your benchmarks and act on it. You can't even live without hanging your body on something your mind agrees to. Your heart responds with enough confidence, you can begin to verify it in experience. God says His Word is the most certain thing to do that with. And He defines faith as action based on His Word, and everything else, a pistis, is faith focused in the wrong direction. That's the subject I've been on for 9 years. Historians stuck their neck out. It was so convenient. Weiss proved that Herodotus was right. Well, Herodotus was not necessarily right. Furthermore, if it hadn't been a forgery, the word really means Lord of Lights. And another person, Lord of Lights, or building in honor of the Lord of Lights, could have put the cartouche in there, and old Cheops decided, that's a good name for me to take. And he stole it and made it his cartouche and put it on a mine over in Sinai. There is no proof that it was built during Cheops' reign. I believe God gave the plan, as Josephus said. Josephus says that the descendants of Seth, knowing that a great devastation was coming on the earth, built two monuments, one of brick, one of stone. The one of stone stands to this day, he said, first century. Stands to this day in the land of Sirius, Egypt, where they worship the dog star. None other than the pyramid. And Josephus' statement is, descendants of Seth, build it as a monument to preserve knowledge through a Holocaust. Through a cataclysm. I have a little comment to read here that's one of the little gems mined out of Atlantis by Charles Berlitz of language school fame, second generation. Atlantis, the eighth continent. I was reading about that last night. I think I folded down something that I might find since I'm paying for the time. I will see if I can't find it. If I folded it down, you're lucky. If I didn't, you'll have to wait another time and another season. I seldom make you do that, so you shouldn't feel badly about it, because you don't have to do that very often. Well, not folded down there. Not folded down there. An Egyptian Copt historian, Masudai, writing during the Middle Ages, I fooled you, I found it, recounted a tradition that the Great Pyramid was built during the reign of the gods, before the flood, to safeguard ancient knowledge. There's two witnesses. Josephus and Masudi, or Masudai. Now, until the Rosetta Stone was found and hieroglyphics were determined to be an alphabetical language and not just caveman picture writings, no one could translate or understand what has come to be called the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, so called because it's a scroll buried with the dead. With the ability to translate the hieroglyphics, thanks to the works of Champollion and others, and from the Rosetta Stone. The Book of the Dead was found to deal with the journey and destiny of the soul. And the pyramid is called the Pillar of Enoch and is described as outlining the descents and the ascents of man's soul. They have a descending passage that is equivalent to truth under law. The children of Israel, from their exodus out of Egypt until the resurrection of Christ, they call it the Hall of Truth and Darkness. The grand gallery that breaks out 286.1 inches in seven risers, called the grand gallery, in the Egyptian Book of the Dead is the Hall of Truth and Light. They called it the Pillar of Enoch. 365 point, the fraction that makes up the solar year, is the exact age of Enoch on the earth. The Enoch circle in the map room is the key to deciphering the pyramid. Enoch's stamp is all over the pyramid. Enoch was a descendant of Seth. Who better for God to tell than this preacher of righteousness that he walked and talked with and that walked and talked with him? Prophecies of the future, and entrust to him either the architectural plan of the pyramid that to those who believe was built after the flood would have been carried through the flood by Noah, or the actual building of it before the flood. In that case, Enoch was the builder. Now, the apocryphal books that are in that three-book group that we're giving you, or not giving you, but making available, Jubilees, Enoch, and Jasher, you'll find many references to Enoch that expand the biblical record that's very brief, including the shocking consternation of those who journeyed to the place where he ascended. Where'd God take him? As we've been teaching from Isaac Vale, there was a great canopy covered the earth, if you take his theories. The earth that then was very different than now. Open at the poles. And the, without an exception, all ancient peoples locate God on the peak of a holy mountain. Now, was the earth that then was arranged in such, was Atlantis with a mountain on it that in some manner went outside the canopy? How did these sons of God come and go from, quote, heaven to earth, who were attracted to the daughters of men and produced the giants that cruelly persecuted men before the flood? Hey, if you think the Bible's a myth, be my guest. But if you believe it, I say to people, if you're going to be a Christian, be one. If you're going to say you believe the Bible, don't be afraid to look at it. Says some rather strange things. I get these questions all the time. What does it mean when the sons of God came down, attracted the daughters of man, mated with them? Well, first off, do you understand what mating is? They were not professional stork callers. It means what it says. I happen to look the Art Tanakh series, probably the finest Jewish expository study on the Old Testament coming out in this decade. I happened to read it yesterday. How did they look on these passages in Genesis where the sons of God came down, mated with the daughters of men? They don't answer it. They quote various rabbis and give you three choices. You make the decision. Choice one, sons of God meant elders and rulers. So the rulers mated with the daughters of ordinary people. That's not likely to produce giants, necessarily. I mean, you know, there's a second step there that needs to be considered. Just because nobles go slumming doesn't guarantee giants. Second choice. Descendants of Seth, sons of God, mated with the descendants of Cain. Cain came from the same womb. I mean, you know, a little common sense tells you quit wiggling. And then they give the third alternative, rather apologetically. Angels. Well, I don't really know what angel means. Angel means messenger of God. And we could open a myriad number of things there. When I preach, I'm a messenger of God, and I ain't no angel. Just wait and see if I got any argument, and glad to see I didn't. The best way to interpret the Bible is assume that it means what it says and that God knows how to talk. Some form of being with access to heaven and access to God, to earth, called sons of God, not descendants of Adam, mated with the daughters of men and produced strange creatures that had to be destroyed. Now, these apocryphal books always refer to these beings as watchers. Some of them came teaching evil things to mankind. Some of them came teaching good things in the period before the flood. And a good question for you to consider, well, I'll save that one. These apocryphal books say Enoch was with the watchers. And when poor old Lamech had Noah, it scared the liver out of him. He looked a way that made him think it wasn't his kid. I think the hint is there that there might have been a watcher in the woodpile. That's what poor old Lamech was worrying about when Noah was born. And he goes to his daddy and says, "You know where Enoch is. Go ask him about this kid that scares me." He's with the watchers. Now, query. Did God take Noah from Atlantis, or rather Enoch from Atlantis, with a bunch of watchers and take them to Egypt and make them build this pyramid there? And as I said in one of the reruns, was this construction crew on R&R and on furlough true to the form of most construction crews when they saw the daughters of men? Don't have to be super mystical. I'm telling you, there wasn't anything mystical about the way they made kids. Or offspring, whatever you want to call them. Now, I believe that the Garden of Eden was on Atlantis. I believe that Adam and Eve were on Atlantis. I believe that their sons, Cain and Abel, were on Atlantis. And I believe Cain was driven from Atlantis. And Seth and their descendants ruled at Atlantis. And when man became evil and God saw what was coming, he walked and talked with Enoch and took him somewhere. Eventually he took him up too, you know. He took him to a place and he headed a construction crew and built pyramid. And it was Atlanteans that set the patterns of the great mysterious buildings that man has been trying to copy, as in Egypt all the tombs are but attempts by subsequent Egyptian dynasties to copy God's pattern. Or they argue that one of the pyramids, they tried to get at the right angle and it collapsed. Baloney. And that was an experiment, and then they finally learned how and built the Pyramid of Giza. The ones who built the Pyramid of Giza knew how to do it going out the gate. Their imitators built one that collapsed. Oh, I tread on a lot of scholastic stuff. And lots of people's reputations hang on these things. That's why it was always hard for Velikovsky to get an audience with his cataclysmic theories. Einstein died with a copy of Velikovsky's works on the desk, and Einstein was pretty smart. Open. I got probably some fundamentalist preacher brethren that the mention of the name Edgar Cayce puts them into spins. He had a much higher ratio than these Word from the Lord people running around. Now, I've said that going out the gate. Usually I dangle more than that. I believe the pyramid is God's I told you so, the prophetic plan of history, God's word in stone, a book in stone, if you will. Masudi wrote that the Great Pyramid was not a tomb, but a book in stone. A book that could be read when generations four in the future possessed enough scientific knowledge to understand its implications. There is evidence that the Great Pyramid has experienced one or more floods, since shells and fossils from the sea have been found around its base, and indications of a salt deposit have been noted in the Queen's Chamber within the pyramid. Now, on that basis, Atlantis is not totally irrelevant to the pyramid. And last night, as we were reading from this book, which is 1984, copyright, Charles Blitz, Atlantis. Am I boring you? Atlantis, the Eighth Continent. We suddenly found ourselves in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, many of you will remember that Richard Weiner wrote a book that made the phrase the Devil's Triangle a household phrase. Since everybody's read it, no sense going to it, haven't you? But he came out with a second one entitled The Devil's Triangle 2. Fewer people have read it. You won't be as bored. It began long ago. This riddle of the Bermuda or Devil's Triangle with the mysterious light observed by Christopher Columbus and his crew the night before his landfall in the New World. You know, everybody studies about Columbus. Why don't they tell you this? Why do they make history so dull? I mean, I could perk up. I know he didn't discover America first. He was a Johnny Come Lately. But I mean, there's gold, there's light. Now, there's something getting my attention in old dull history class. Mysterious light observed by Christopher. How many people know about who Christopher Columbus is? I don't mean to insult you. Everybody knows that. Get your hands up. If you don't, God help you. Now, how many of all of you knew he saw a mysterious light in the Bermuda Triangle? One. A proper percentage. No, I have an unusual congregation. Might be 100 to 1 in my congregation, 1,000 to 1 in the general population. Be 10,000 to 1, a television evangelist crowd that's listening every Sunday. You say, you don't like television evangelists? You got it. Don't you like evangelists? Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, I've seen people around this world, true evangelists. I wasn't worthy to carry their shoes around. This Sunday, carnival stuff. Began long ago, this riddle of the Bermuda or Devil's Triangle, with the mysterious light observed by Christopher Columbus. And some poor fundamentalist just turned in right now. That's my heritage. Don't relax, friend. I love the Bible. A lifetime love affair with it. I respect pastors that plow away and give their life for years in the city and prove by faithful daily performance. And I respect those who teach and preach the word. I just don't respect this constant cheapening of God with gimmickry and sensationalism, judgmental put-downs, finger-pointing haranguing that goes on. And I'm particularly angry that its saturation of the airways is suggesting that that's normal Christianity. The freak show has become the norm. Don't like it. Doing my best to separate from it. But I love God's Word. Lifetime love affair with it. I'm tired of everyday hard-working, supporting Christians being dumped on because you happen to salivate. It began long ago, this riddle of the Bermuda or Devil's Triangle, with the mysterious light observed by Christopher Columbus and his crew the night before his landfall in the New World. Do you realize what an auditorium he could have filled if he had wanted to evangelize on that light? Enigmatic phenomenon have continued ever since in this area of the Southwest Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. It's a region that begins right at our back door. Here are the ports of no return. Ships that sail away into oblivion. Aircraft that melt away into the thin air of their skies. Someone years ago observed that the British had gone around the world uncovering mysteries and ignored the greatest mysteries, the stone circles at their own door, and the old straight line paths, the ley lines. You could bemoan the fact that we go to the moon and circle the globe, but very few American, United States citizens know anything about the Bermuda Triangle. Right at our door. Here are ports of no return. The Devil's Triangle has joined such journalistic misnomers as abominable snowmen and flying saucers. Now, this is from the foreword of The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. Vincent H. Gaddis is writing the foreword. It implies boundaries that limit the locations of the phenomena. The author of this book has better described it as a trapezium, a four-sided area in which no two sides or angles are the same. And the first four letters of the word trapezium more than adequately describe it. Trap. It was the disappearance of Flight 19. Wasn't it Close Encounters of the Third Kind that had these missing pilots suddenly show up? It was the disappearance of Flight 19, a patrol of 5 torpedo bombers. 5 torpedo bombers. Disappeared. No oil slick, no wreck remnants, nada. Nicht. Or whatever. It was the disappearance of Flight 19, a patrol of 5 torpedo bombers, followed by the disappearance of a large Mariner with a crew of 13 men sent to aid the patrol that attracted international attention to this area. 5 torpedo bombers, a large Mariner with a crew of 13, gone. Talk about a dangler. It remains aviation's strangest mystery. How could 6 aircraft and 27 crewmen totally vanish, leaving behind no discoverable wreckage? Bodies or oil slicks? Despite one of the largest sea land searches on record. As the years passed, other total disappearances of aircraft and vessels followed. And a few observers began to wonder. The genesis of the Devil's Triangle mystery may be of interest. In 1950, I was news editor of an Indiana radio station. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
On September 16th of that year, the Associated Press released in Miami, Florida, a short feature story by E.V.W. Jones. Perhaps the first newsman to take notice of a series of total vanishments. Total vanishments. It covered the Flight 19 disappearance and those of 3 airlines and 2 ships. 3 more airlines. 2 ships. Total. Not a trace. No slick. No oil. No nothing. Now, I was reading last night. Let me leave that there for a minute. I was reading last night some of Charles Berlitz's accounts in the area after his interview with Dr. Valentine, who discovered and spent almost 2 decades exploring the underwater walls beginning in 1968, the very year that Edgar Cayce said Atlantis would begin to be found in the area of Bimini. What appears to be a causeway, highway, under the sea, in an area covered by the sea 10 to 12,000 years ago with melting glaciers. And since the highway was on the top of the causeway, digging under it would no doubt reveal buildings underneath, cornerstones fitted, no accidental beach rocks. He then began to describe some strange happenings in the area of the Bermuda Triangle or the Devil's Triangle. One was an experience encountered by Ed Wilson. Now I'm back into Atlantis, the 8th Continent with Charles Berlitz, page 103. Ed Wilson, once a mayor candidate for Orlando, Florida, on June 7, 1948. He was piloting an open Waco with a Continental engine equipped for 12-hour flights engaged in shallow bottom treasure hunting by air. Now, this is where we were last night, right? That other stuff the Weiner's talking about is old history. Airliners disappearing, ships disappearing, torpedo bombers disappearing. Nothing. Now, he's flying in the area. This Waco with the Continental engine was equipped for 12-hour flights, engaged in shallow bottom treasure hunting by air, flying low over the water, looking down, trying to see things underneath the water. This is a direct quote by Ed Wilson. I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami and flying at about 250 feet above sea level when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me. It bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upward. Now, last night we had already read of evidence of a giant pyramid. And in the sonar soundings, we showed you a picture of a stiletto-type appearance, the peak of which was 200 fathoms down on the plateau of one of these islands that could represent mountaintops and high plateaus of ancient Atlantis before it sunk. Otto Munk's descriptions of the rifts on each side and the possibility of how it could have sunk is the heart of his book. Now, if these were the high regions of ancient Atlantis, there's a pyramid there, peak of which is about 200 fathoms up. We were reading some experienced divers finding this pyramid on one occasion. Now, he's flying. A hissing, smashing updraft hit me. It bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upward. Now, I have been in updrafts and downdrafts, none like this. After I got back to more or less normal, I noticed that the water had become bright and silvery. I noticed something big under the water and thought it was a wrecked ship. It was not far from the surface. Something was causing the water to rush past it at a fast rate. It curled around it and made a deep channel. The ocean seemed to be opening up, and I was now flying low in a sort of trough in the water with both sides of it along the wingtips. I suddenly realized that what I was looking at was not a ship at all, but seemed to be a huge building down in the water. The water seemed to get shallower around it. I could see a slanting side of a building that looked like a mountain. I was down at about 50 feet from the surface and could see it in the water. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. At my point of angle, and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see. Now, that's about where we were last night, isn't it? I got all the way back to where I was last night, didn't I? And some people left me last night in the middle of a sentence and didn't even tell me where they're interested in this. Now, those cities that don't leave us, I'll give you a promise, conditioned on some calls in the next 3 minutes. I'm going to go much further tonight. Landsat 2, you remember that satellite? Saw those 8 dots in the jungles of the Amazon. Turned out to be pyramids, only slightly lower, almost as high as the Great Pyramid of Giza. And then low-flying planes have discovered there are 12 in 2 even rows of 6 each. Now we've got a pyramid, maybe, underneath the water in the Bermuda Triangle. Right? Now, if you are interested and you call, I'll stay on this subject. Even if you're leaving, you might get me back on it all next week. But you've got to beg me a little. You say, what arrogance. That's the way I feel about teaching. We're in a devil's triangle right now because I believe that there must be confronted the fact that Edgar Cayce in 1940 said, Remnants of Atlantis would be found around Bimini. In 68 or 69, or very shortly thereafter. In 68, Dr. Valentine began to find the roads and the walls. And no question, they're not beach rock. They are constructed stone fitted together with cornerstones. No question. Why all the mysterious happenings in what Richard Weiner called the Devil's Triangle, that famous one of the planes disappearing, and 27 men, not a trace, boats, airlines. Nobody paid much attention, by the way, to that jet that lost both engines, you remember, over the Caribbean and was able to start them up just before it got into Florida after the long glide. Nobody even linked that to the Bermuda Triangle, did they? Just some error made. But some of them, 5 torpedo boats, 1 mariner, don't disappear without a trace. Now, some of the yachts and boats that have disappeared, maybe they were hijacked. The planes ultimately have to land. And did the sinking of Atlantis also sink something else that affects the area? I'm reading Ed Wilson, former mayoral candidate, Orlando, Florida, his report of a happening on June 7, 1948. Out of Atlantis, the Eighth Continent, by Charles Berlitz. I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami. Can I read this again? I got a full hour, so I'll get past the other point if I don't get sidetracked. I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami and flying about 250 feet above sea level when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me. He was in an open Waco with a Continental engine, equipped for 12-hour flights, engaged in shallow-bottom treasure hunting by air, when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me. It bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upward. Now, I've been in updrafts and downdrafts, none like this. After I got back to more or less normal, I noticed that the water had become bright and silvery. I noticed something big under the water. Thought it was a wrecked ship. It was not far from the surface. Something was causing the water to rush past it at a fast rate. It curled around it and made a deep channel. The ocean seemed to be opening up. I was now flying low in a sort of trough in the water with both sides of it, the trough, that is, along the wingtips. I'm glad I wasn't with him. I suddenly realized that what I was looking at was not a ship at all, but seemed to be a huge building down in the water. The water seemed to get shallower around it. I could see a slanting side of a building that looked like a mountain. I was down at about 50 feet from the surface and could see it in the water. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see. Now, I read to you last night about, an expedition in search of the alleged pyramid that had been alleged to be around Kaisal was organized in 1978 by Ari Marshall, a Greek industrialist interested. You need to have these two together, the mayor and this guy. A Greek industrialist interested in the age-old legend of Atlantis. His expedition actually took closed-circuit television footage of a pyramidal mound off the Kaisal bank at a depth of over 750 feet. Ari Marshall remembers some details. Quote, "The first thing we noticed when we got near the area was that all the compasses were going berserk. We spent 8 hours making tapes, starting at 700 feet to 1,500 feet deep. We would go about a mile, then make a 90-degree turn, and go back again. Finally, I saw it. Finally, I saw it coming up on the sonar screen. I told the captain to stop." Very difficult for him, I'm sure. "And then to proceed slowly. We were right over the pyramid. The top seemed to be about 150 feet from the surface, with the total depth about 650 feet. We lowered the camera, and high-intensity lights down the side of the mass, and suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening by turbulence. They may have been gas or some sort of energy crystals. Further down, the same thing happened in reverse. Light flashes or shining white objects were coming out again. At a lower level, it was surprising that the water in this deep area was green instead of black near the pyramid, even at night." Now, that was Ari Marshall's report of his underwater exploration. Now, here's Ed Wilson's report of his overwater. "I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays, I could see." Now, I want to show you something. This area is strange. In 1950, back to this story. We'll get back to that. In 1950, I was news editor. Got to put all these things. This is very interesting. In 1950, I was news. You know, when I say am I boring you, I check up on whether or not you got an interest category or an interest capacity. It interests me. It interests anybody. It's smart. 1950, I was news editor of an Indiana radio station. On September 16th of that year, the Associated Press released in Miami, Florida, a short feature story by E.V.W. Jones, perhaps the first newsman. Oh, this is The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. I don't know where to get one of these. If I could, I'd tell you. If we can find them, we'll get them. By E.V.W. Jones, perhaps the first newsman to take notice of the series of total vanishments in the area. It covered the Flight 19 disappearance the five torpedo planes and the mariner that went to search for them, and 27 men vanished without a trace. His story also covered the total disappearance of three airline planes and two ships. Total disappearance. No oil slick. No debris. Nothing. Intrigued by the account, I placed the story in my personal file of the bizarre and bewildering. Perhaps the first national magazine article to deal with these events as a series was by George X. Sand, appearing in the October 1952 issue of Fate. It covered the same disappearance as the AP story, but in far greater depth, and added the case of internationally famous horse racing jockey Al Snyder. The jockey vanished with two friends while on a fishing trip. Not a trace. That, too, went into my file. As time allowed, I launched a research campaign. This is the guy writing the editorial to this Devil's Triangle 2, Vincent H. Gaddis. I launched a research campaign including instances of seaworthy vessels found strangely abandoned, as well as electromagnetic and meteorological erratics. Having turned to freelance writing, my article on the Devil's Triangle appeared in Argosy magazine in February 1964. It captured the interest of many readers and was reprinted in the Netherlands, Great Britain, Australia, and elsewhere, and was widely quoted. This data was rewritten and expanded in my book, Invisible Horizons, by Chilton, 1965, which is currently in its fifth printing. Today, the Devil's Triangle is a household term. Well, it needs to be resurrected for people to start asking some questions. There are many theories advocated to explain the Devil's Triangle mystery. Some are bizarre. Apollo astronauts and high-flying pilots have commented on the white water that appears in the region. It seems as if there is continual agitation stirring below the surface. Now, you know something. Those demons were assigned to the deep. And go on. It seems as if there is continual agitation stirring below the surface. Since Edgar Cayce, the famed psychic, placed Atlantis in this area, it has been suggested that the inhabitants of the lost continent left behind on the ocean floor a sophisticated power source that operates to create magnetic fields and stress on the surface and above. Whatever is the answer to the triangle mystery, magnetic and electrical forces seem to be a part of it. Radar images of objects in view appear and disappear from screens. Intense bluish glows can flood cockpits, and aircraft bodies can become luminous under conditions eliminating St. Elmo's fire. Electrical systems on some boats and planes have been completely burned out. In one instance, an airliner flying through calm, clear weather experienced purplish, static electrical discharges that covered the entire windshield with a blinding glow. And you know Columbus saw a glow, and his crew, and never could explain it in the area. He found what he thought was India, and he saw a glow. The captain decided to ignore the cockpit instruments and trust the readout of an emergency battery-operated gyro horizon. And with radar assistance from Bermuda, the plane landed safely. There it was found that the craft's electrical system had been destroyed, and it was later necessary to completely rewire the plane and replace all the instruments. Now, present time. According to physicist Wayne Meshagian, of Longwood College, Virginia, some kind of energy force is affecting polar orbiting weather satellites when they are over the Devil's Triangle. These satellites transmit pictures of weather conditions in a sequence of two. First, a clear picture, then an infrared one. Since two pictures cannot be sent at the same time, the infrared one is stored momentarily on magnetic tape. What happens, he says, is that the infrared picture is wiped off his receiver. Why only over this part of the earth, he asks, does that happen? Why is it so localized? Until we know the causes of all this, the Devil's Triangle and similar areas will continue to be places of mystery. Regions where the advancing frontiers of human knowledge are on the edge of the unknown. Man has walked on the moon. Our space vehicles have crashed on Mars. By the end of the century, some scientists predict we'll have communicated with other solar systems. And yet we know less about our oceans and seas than we do about the moon. We have yet to reach the bottoms of our oceans to see what's really down there. So the world beneath the sea is still a place of mystery, even to oceanographers, let alone poor laymen like us. One small sector of the Atlantic Ocean is permeated with more mystery and unexplained occurrences than all of the other oceans. These mysterious waters are often referred to as the Devil's Triangle. For here, more ships, airplanes, yachts, and people have vanished without any trace whatsoever than on any other body of water. Show you a picture. I like pictures. Particularly for the radio people. Love pictures. Just love pictures. Love pictures. Let's see if we can pick this up. Can't find it. I was sure I could find it. Maybe it's in this third group. There it is. See if you can pick up the contrast. Yeah, that's pretty good, Jerry. That's an ocean shot. Stop right there. Come in a little closer. Right there. Doesn't that look like a hole? This round hole in the ocean plunges suddenly down from the shallow 3 fathoms Bahama banks surrounding it, just 3 fathoms the gray area around, to a depth which has not yet been firmly established. I mean, you know, I've waded around in hip boots a few times and stepped in a hole. But that's a something else kind of hole. Just straight down. Depth recorders have not found bottom at 2,800 feet. The diameter of the hole can be gauged by comparing it with the 50-foot carry craft to the right of center. Now, 6 times that would be a football field. So that'll give you some idea of the size of the hole. Don't practice walking on stilts around here. The mysterious deaths, in spite of the great Frenchman's explorations. Now, before I go back to that Mayor flying. In October 1954, still reading from The Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner, the Coast Guard buoy tender, Smilax, was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along the South Carolina coast, where she was to replace or repair buoys and other navigational aids that had been damaged or destroyed by Hurricane Hazel several days earlier. Let me tell you girls something. When you fell for that bill of goods that equality demanded that hurricanes be named after men on occasions, you forfeited the greatest proof of your superiority. I don't care how you slice it. One of the awfulest things in the world is to relax because of a hurricane named Peter or John or David. Those feminine names kept you on your guard. You lost, ladies, in the name of equality. You lost the greatest proof of your superiority blowing on the windy seas. Just thought I'd put that in. Sometimes you can engage in overkill, lose more than you gain. As long as they were naming hurricanes after women, every man had to stop and say, don't push her too far. This is interesting. I gotta look into this a little better. Wait just a minute. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Now look at this a little closer. On October 1954, the Coast Guard buoy tender Smilax was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along South Carolina coast where she was to replace or repair buoys and other navigational aids that had been damaged and destroyed by Hurricane Hazel several days earlier. Winds of 150 miles per hour had slammed into the Carolina coast at 9 a.m. on October 15th. 98 lives were lost in the United States. In Canada alone, property damage was in excess of $251 million. As the 100-foot Smilax crossed Ossabaw Sound near Savannah, she ran into a very dense fog. Seaman, second class, Ike Levine, now Master Chief Boatswain's Mate at the Fort Lauderdale Coast Guard Station, took over the bow watch just before midnight. Once each minute, the vessel's foghorn bellowed out in five-second blasts as the Smilax felt her way through the mist at a speed of under 2 knots. From ahead came the sound of another foghorn. With each blast, the source of the sound seemed to be getting closer. Chief Warrant Officer Creech, in command of the buoy tender, brought his ship to a stop. The sound of the foghorn ahead continued to blast through the fog, but came no closer. Thinking that the other vessel had also stopped, Creech waited. The sound of the other horn came no closer. Creech ordered the Smilax to move slowly ahead. The radar in the bridge showed no other vessel in the vicinity. A minute later, the foghorn of the ship that wasn't there sounded from astern. Still, the radar screen indicated no other vessel in any direction. Then Levine thought he heard the foghorn of another ship ahead somewhere. The radar showed nothing but the shoreline and a buoy. the seaman tightened his grip on the cold, wet bow rail. Again, he heard a fog horn from somewhere ahead in the fog. The first horn was getting lower, as though it was drifting or moving further astern. You ever heard a fog horn on one of those boats? The new horn seemed to be getting louder, yet the radar continued to show only the shoreline and the buoy. It was a U.S. Coast Guard ship. Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. The Coast Guard vessel drifted. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Strange things happen in this triangle. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. We're in the Devil's Triangle, and it's a Coast Guard buoy tender in the fog, hearing boats blowing fog horns that don't show on the radar. So they stopped to let a boat pass that isn't there. Once more, Creech stopped. Did I review that quickly enough? Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. That's the Coast Guard vessel, Memphis. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. Creech ordered Levine to turn on the carbon arc searchlight. As the seaman was plugging in the connection for the carbon arc light, the men on the Smilax, I'd change its name, heard still another fog horn from somewhere ahead. And as before, the radar gave no indication of any ship or boat within its range. The searchlight beam penetrated a short distance into the fog and disappeared. Then suddenly, from above, then, suddenly, from above, then, suddenly, from above, came a, then, I got it memorized, suddenly, from above, came a then suddenly from above. You know, if I go walk some of them streets down there in Deep South, there'll be some of these people kill me for this. Then suddenly from above came a beam of light shining down on the Smilax. How it kept smiling is beyond me. The beam moved from just ahead of the ship to directly over it. There was no aircraft above the vessel. The night was dead, dead still, except for the strange foghorns and the Smilax's own whistle. I don't know how it could pucker its lips. Levine, I'm boring you. We've got to get back to this mayor candidate, you know. Levine tilted his searchlight straight up at the other light. Game of chicken. The other light went out. As Levine turned his light back down toward the water, the buoy tender emerged from the fog. Don't look at me that way. I didn't tell this story. I'm just reading it. I wasn't on that boat. The night ahead was clear. There were no other craft in sight. Still, the men of the Smilax could hear the strange foghorns. Let's try another one. The USCGC, that's acronym for United States Coast Guard Cutter, Yamacraw. Well, with names like Smilax and Yamacraw, I'd attack them too if I was the devil. Yamacraw was a former World War II mine layer converted by the Coast Guard to a combination cable laying and research ship. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. The large letters on her hull disclosed her designation, WARC 333. The name Yamacraw was derived from a tribe of Florida Indians. Captain of the 189-foot ship was Commander William D. Strouch. Her normal complement was 51 crew members. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
All I'm doing is picking a few strange happenings in the area called Devil's Triangle. So we've got to get back to this guy here, though. This guy flying. On August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 180 or 165 degrees. Her position was 30.65 north and 73.80 west, which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Sargasso Sea, otherwise known as Seaweed Sea, where them eels breed. An area north and east of the Bahamas and approximately 500 miles east of Jacksonville. It was 0130 hours when the radar operator called out, "Large landmass dead ahead. Range 28 miles. "Impossible," responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. "There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic over 800 miles away." The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. "Ensign Flynn, the radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself." Flynn studied the radar screen. "You're right," he said. "It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix." The sea was flat and smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. The compasses were correct, and the ensign's sightings tallied with his previous fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Yamacraw's course. Steaming at 12.5 knots, the ship had reduced the distance 24 miles. "Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a huge, dark..." Let's go back to this guy. Now let's go back to this guy, this flyer here. Am I boring you? You torture me and make me wait for my budget. You put me through hell and drive me right up to the wire. Kill me with fatigue. Bring me to the point of quitting every day. My turn now. You say, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." What I'm doing, making it mine. The Lord said, "Vengeance is mine." was I reading? No, it's his book. I know what's in the other book. Where is that mayor's airplane? That's what I said, 103. I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami, flying about 250 feet above sea level, when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me, bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upward. Flying low now in a trough in the water, I suddenly realized that what I was looking at was not a ship at all, but seemed to be a huge building down in the water. The water seemed to get shallower around it. I could see a slanting side of a building that looked like a mountain. I was down at about 50 feet from the surface and could see it in the water. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I read this before, didn't I?
Yes, sir.
And I could even, but not for the folks in Nashville and Winston-Salem and Richmond and Norfolk. I circled around it for about a minute and a half, and I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see. Now, another diver did something strange in this area. Yeah. A diving experience in Bahama waters related by Dr. Ray Brown, a diver and lecturer of Mesa, Arizona, indicates how the sea bottom can change as a result of a violent storm. Within the Bermuda Triangle, such a storm can sometimes uncover ruins for a short time, only before they're buried again under the seafloor. Dr. Brown, I'll go back to the flyer, and I'll go back to the sea and the Coast Guard and the Mass. That's not a Catholic experience. Dr. Brown, who was familiar with the Berry Islands of the Bahamas, where he had previously searched for Spanish treasure galleons, returned there in 1970. I'm boring you.
No, sir.
He detailed his experience in an interview with the author. I'm in Atlantis, the Eighth Continent by Charles Berlitz. We're going to have some of these in our bookstore. Quote, when we returned to where we had been before looking for the sunken galleons, a violent squall came up. We had to hang on to the mangroves on the island. It was so violent. 6 to 8 foot waves broke over us. We lost most of our equipment. In the morning, this was 1970. In the morning, we saw that our compasses were spinning and our magnetometers were not giving readings. We took off northeast from the island, determined by the stars, the compasses were gone. It was murky, but suddenly we could see outlines of buildings under the water. It seemed to be a large, exposed area of an underwater city. We were 5 divers, and we all jumped in and dove down looking for anything we could find. As we swam on, the water became clearer. I was close to the bottom at 135 feet and was trying to keep up with the diver ahead of me. I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. I was reluctant to go inside. I was reluctant to go inside, but I swam in anyway. The opening was like a shaft debouching into an inner room. I saw something shining. It was... Let's go back to the flight now. Or maybe we should go back to the mass. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe, no more than a mile. I'm back to the mass. Devil's Triangle. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe, no more awe, no more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea. Was a huge, dark, mass that seemed to stretch from horizon to horizon and reach skyward as high as the men could see. The radar, which was capable of penetrating fog, showed this to be a solid mass. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strouch ordered his men, I'm going to touch that, to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved along slowly, parallel to the mass, the men noticed that... Let's go back to the ship. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays, I could see this huge building clearly visible down under the water. I started to time myself on the leg out to get readings of the location when out of this blue, clear day, another strange incident occurred. All my magnetics had gone to zero. Then a strange hue occurred all around me. At about 600 feet above water in the air, that bright crimson hue simply baffled me. That 240 horsepower Continental began to be the most crazily running engine I've ever had the experience to feel. It became motionless. No matter what I did with the throttle and pumps, it glided and floated smoothly for at least 2 miles. Then the engine simply started itself. I couldn't dive because I was already on top of the water. Then I realized that some force was pulling toward a westerly direction. Now, after all this, I finally got back to the airport with my Bendix blasting hell out of everybody, but not one single band would respond. After landing and getting inspection of radio communication and units, every last unit was blown, shorted out to some high-frequency electronic shock or mysterious high voltage in the air. They said I might have run through a magnetic belt or something. Over the past years, I've been back many times, but I could never sight it again. A lot of damn Miamians made fun of my story, but I know I'm right. You've hit with the sonar instruments the very object I talked about in exactly the same area. Now, he is saying that about somebody else that found this pyramid thing. Now, I skipped a couple of lines. When I jumped down, I started to leg myself. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see this huge building clearly visible down under the water. I thought I saw... Now, let's go back to... Oh, no, this other guy. The swimmer. I was reluctant to go inside. Now, wait a minute. This other fellow over here... Harry, remember? Harry Marshall said, first thing I noticed, he's underwater exploring. He organized the Greek industrialist. He organized the expedition in 78. and was down there with closed-circuit television footage, found this pyramidal mound off the Kaisal Bank at a depth of 750 feet. We were right over the pyramid. The top seemed to be about 150 feet from the surface, with a total depth of about 650 feet. We lowered the camera and the high-intensity lights down the side of the mass and suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening by turbulence. Further down, the same thing happened in reverse. They were coming out again, lower level. Now this swimmer, back to him. As we swam on, the water became clear. It was close to the bottom at 135 feet. Trying to keep up the diver ahead of me, I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. I was reluctant to go inside, but I swam in anyway. The opening was like a shaft debouching into an inner room. I saw something shining. It was a crystal held by two metallic hands. I had on my gloves, and I tried to loosen it. It became loose. As soon as I grabbed it, I felt this was the time to get out and not come back. I'm not the only person who's seen these ruins. Others have seen them from the air and say they're 5 miles wide and more than that in length. Reports from the other divers who were with Dr. Brown at the time are unavailable, since three of them have died or disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle while diving. Dr. Brown still has the crystal, which he sometimes shows to lecture audiences. Inside the round crystal can be seen a series of pyramidal forms. When one holds the crystal, as this author did, a throbbing sensation is felt in the hand of the holder, whether by autosuggestion or some quality inherent in the object. Back to the mass. Oh, here's another story, too. October 21st, 1962 was the 50th wedding anniversary of Anthony and Emma Hessler of Fort Lauderdale. Who cares? To celebrate, they took a 3-day cruise to Nassau aboard the SS Florida. The big white cruise ship sailed from Miami at about 5:15 on Friday, 5:15 p.m. October 19th. Holding hands, the Hesslers stood. Isn't that cute? At the rail on the promenade deck, looking back at the vessel's wake and the Miami skyline silhouetted with the late afternoon sun. The sky was cloudless. The sea was flat, calm. The only wind was that created by the ship's movement. At approximately 7 o'clock, the Hesslers sat down at their table in the dining room for their evening meal. They had just been served their soup and salad when suddenly Emma Hessler found herself sitting on the deck, covered with her food. Curious, full of sympathy. Trays of food were flying across the room. Chairs, tables, food, and people were sliding across the dining room. The ship had suddenly listed 45 degrees to the port. Then slowly, very slowly. Let's go back to the mass. For half an hour, the Yamacraw steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, do you realize I've been going for 2 hours? Are you convinced this is a strange area? And there seems to be some remarkable consistency of pyramid-like encounters. Shall I continue?
Yes, sir.
Not unless you call me. Not unless you call me. I mean, you know, I talk 55 minutes. I'm entitled to get somebody to talk to me for 5 minutes. I don't know whether anybody's going to be in the King's House Sunday. I have a jet. I could be over to the edge of the Bermuda Triangle. Don't think I want to fly over it. Just soon land at Miami and get some binoculars and stare out there. Come think of it, I'm not sure I ever want to fly over that area.